Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to an Empire Podcast interview special with a difference. It's Friday, January 9th, folks, and usually Friday is new Empire Podcast Day. Hooray! But this particular Friday is the day when we record the new Empire Podcast live at King's Place London to mark 700 episodes of the show. Blimey. And with that being recorded tonight, that means it won't be up until Saturday at the earliest. And so, to tide you over until then, here are two interviews we did earlier. Today, Jan 9th, as well as marking our 14th anniversary as an award-winning podcast, sees the release of Chloe Zhao's Hamnet, a stunning drama that is set to be one of the Oscar frontrunners this year. Adapted from the book by Maggie O'Farrell, it tells the tale of the marriage between William Shakespeare, yes, that William Shakespeare, played by Paul Mescal, and his wife Agnes, played by Jessie Buckley, and what happens to them emotionally, spiritually, artistically, when they are met with unimaginable tragedy. Buckley and Mescal, two of Ireland's finest exports, are extraordinary in this movie, and so we jumped at the chance to pair them with another of Ireland's finest exports, our very own Helen O'Hara, just before Christmas. Paul and Jesse were on Zoom for this. They were in Ireland, I believe, actually. And this is a multifaceted chat in which our intrepid trio dig into art, emotion, Shakespeare, and of course, Santa Claus? Huh. All will become clear. Enjoy.
Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you doing?
We're doing
brilliant.
Good.
Yeah. As I came online, you were talking about method Santa Clauses. Can you explain further?
No, we did an interview and now I think we fucked
we're
it.
We're very excited.
We just lost the run of ourselves and we said that maybe the great Christmas movie that we would make would be make like a kitchen sink drama between Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus that like there's a like...
It's a Who's Afraid, a hybrid of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
But as Santa Claus and Mrs. Santa Claus.
And she's an alcoholic and he's a narcissist.
Yeah.
And he's
on his last trip and he promised it'd be the last one, but he's decided to go hard.
But he'll never stop.
Be method Santa this year.
Yeah.
And so he's put on loads of weight.
Yeah.
Even more weight. He's got even bigger. Got
even it. Bigger, right?
She's secretly drinking and smoking and she's
having an affair with the head elf.
Yeah.
No.
Hot small elf.
A hot small elf.
And she actually doesn't like children.
Oh my God. This sounds incredible. So you've basically taken Raymond Briggs' Father Christmas and thought, you know what? We can go grittier than that. That's
yeah, but
not
like,
good.
And it's right on the edge between like serious drama and then like total comedy.
Yeah.
I'm in. Where do I sign? Yeah. I do a Christmas movies podcast as well. This can feature next year. We'll lock that in right now for the publicity.
Okay.
Run.
Yeah. But apparently you can't. This has no legs because Coca-Cola owns Santa Claus and you're not able to tarnish the look. So
I don't think that's true.
There goes that dream.
Well, we wouldn't tarnish them, making them human. We would be making them like this is, of course, Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus. Must go through the ringer. Imagine the stress in that house 2 weeks before Christmas.
100%.
They must be up the walls. And he's like...
And which he's just...
Bananas. He's gone mad with power.
Mad with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got
and she's left all on her own while every other family in the whole world
gets Christmas.
Gets Santa Claus. And she doesn't get anything.
And does she experience time the same way he does? So it's like a subjective, like... infinity while he's delivering all these toys.
That's even worse.
I'm wondering. Yeah,
because it's like being in like outer space, isn't it? It's like time is never ending.
And then when he comes home, he always promises that he's going to be there, but he's so exhausted from,
of course,
spending so much energy that he actually takes a week away to like decompress.
Oh.
Then comes and realizes that Mrs. Claus is it's over. She's gone. She's left a note saying. I've gone with Bernard the Elf. Bernard the Elf is in Santa Claus.
Yeah.
No, do you know
David Krumholtz? Would he play himself?
Yeah, he could play himself. Who would you want to play the head elf?
I did say Will Ferrell, but he just because he is like synonymous with Christmas films. Be a good.
Do you know who would be great?
Josh.
Josh would be a great head elf.
He's not small though.
But I think we would just. I don't
you
think
you can shrink him.
Oh, he'd be so cute.
Such a cute chunk.
Yeah.
I'd watch this. I think this is genuinely going to be the next Christmas classic. I think you're onto something. Speaking of demystifying, like, well-known figures, brings us to Hamlet and Hamnet.
Ah, very good. Very
Shakespeare.
Good.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
First of all, congratulations on this film, even though you made me cry more than any other film this year. Tell me about this. Tell me about working with each other on this.
It was the most gorgeous experience. I think we met each other at the perfect, because we obviously knew each other a little bit beforehand, but we went into it with, or speaking for myself, with this like immense respect for Jessie's work and this like real curiosity to see how she works. But then on top of that, I think we just built this incredibly like robust relationship and collaboration that just feels like it supersedes the film for me anyway. And yeah,
it was like a kind of once in a lifetime thing. Like, sometimes just all the parts, like Paul, Chloe, the kids, Lukasz, the story, Max Richter, Maggie O'Farrell, the collision of all these people coming together. And I think everybody who came into this needed to tell this story at this moment in their life. And those things just don't happen, you know. And with Paul, I feel like I've met somebody that I will meet many times in my life and have very important, significant, like, experiences as an actor with and as a friend. And I'm really, really proud of the work we did in this. Yeah. I'm so grateful for the relationships and friendships I've found in it. And it's reminded me of what storytelling can be and what cinema can be, you know, that it doesn't, that it's, it can really be something that has such an effect.
Mm. Yeah, on I feel like everyone who's seen it, it's been something that's, it's weirdly a sort of theme of this year has been there have been several really great films that talk about the importance of art to say things that words can't, and it feels like it's something that maybe we all need to be reminded of right now, and sort of talking about with, you know, all the chat about AI and all this nonsense, it feels like it's a good time to be reminded that there is a point to all of this. It's not just pretty stories.
Well, sometimes it's hard to find the words to describe the landscape that we find ourselves in, you know, and like sometimes there's not even the language for it yet. And I think art is always a place for us to, in an abstract way, just like feel the things that we need to feel and share and like recognize outside of ourselves, because it's too much to hold on our own. That's the whole vessel of storytelling in whatever form, whether that's in painting, books, cinema, you know. And I definitely feel like that's true for this moment.
So tell me about Chloe as well. She sounds like she brings a lot of, and I say this in a very complimentary fashion, witchy energy to a set.
Yeah.
She's very guided by instinct, a bit like maybe Agnes herself.
Yeah, big time. Like, I think she just carries, she doesn't work like from a
heady
place at all. It's like intuition, instinct, she works physically. We did a lot of work on that before we started.
She's like a deeply connected and curious person. Mm-hmm. You know, in between making these incredible films that she's made, she's always going to try and discover, like, she's doing like a death workshop or studying dreams, or, you know, like, she's constantly excavating her soul to try and connect a little bit further. And it's a very brave thing to do, you know. It's really easy to live in your head and project an idea of what you think you can control in your life, but I think Chloe is constantly, she calls it a spiral, and she works in a very kind of feminine place in that way, to kind of spiral herself into a place of unknowability so that she can discover something within herself.
And yet she said she was kind of almost scared of it, particularly Agnes, before doing this. Like, she turned down the film initially. I think, Paul, you essentially talked her back into it. What made her hesitate? And maybe it's just because she didn't know what it was at that point.
Yeah, I think Chloe has said this before, but it's like, it's a film that, like, is really curious about the concept of motherhood. It's also like there's this
It's also about letting go and surrendering, you know, and I think Agnes is very much somebody who goes through a journey of learning to constantly let go. And so does Will.
Yeah.
Like, this is about kind of letting go and so that you can see something again.
Yeah.
Like
reincarnation of a feeling or a...
Yeah.
Like, how do you... And like, as an artist, like Chloe's artistry, like, it's a big question and it's a scary question for... And I think had Chloe not been afraid of it, or myself or yourself, it's like... Then I think you would have... We would have been the wrong people to do it if there wasn't a latent fear that goes with that. Because it's also, there's this thing of like, Shakespeare's very precious to a lot of people. And I think the film does benefit from people who aren't English or British playing those parts in it. Like, obviously I feel biased to that because we got to do it, but I do think that it does remove a kind of like preciousness. Like, I don't think we're precious or Chloe is precious. Maggie at all, and I think it's this version of this film benefits from that. It's not to say that there's other versions of this film that could be brilliant in other people's hands, but I think that this was the film that the three of us and everybody else made together.
Paul in particular, are you beginning a process of sort of anti-colonization by taking these British heroes like Shakespeare and Paul McCartney and making them Irish? Is that what you're doing?
I'm doing Paul McCartney with an Irish accent. That's the big take. No, there's none of that.
No, he's doing those roles because he's a giant of a human. You know, it's no coincidence that he goes from Gladiator to Shakespeare to Paul McCartney. Not many people can fill those spaces, and Shakespeare and Paul McCartney are absolute humanists.
And Santa Claus next.
Yeah.
But not your one. Your one's going to be a narcissist.
Mine's going to be a narcissist. Yeah, we're going to.
Oh.
Yeah. We're starting now.
I know there were definitely scenes in this film that were, I'm sure, very difficult to film. Were there scenes that you know, were joyful and that you particularly loved?
I mean, even the difficult ones were like, they weren't joyful, they were intense, but there was a lot of, it was a privilege to get to go to those places. But, you know, those first scenes where they meet and fall in love and they just, the energy between them was so epic and electrical, and we were just tearing around fields and through forests, and that first scene when they meet in the barn for the first time, like, there was just this wild electricity. And sometimes Chloe would do a kind of silent take where we would blast music, take away all the dialogue, but everything that was being said was being said just with our bodies. And like, some of those scenes were just so alive and joyous.
Or like, I remember like Mark, our first AD, calling action like from a distance, and we were running around in a field that was like 100 feet away. We were coming into the scene where they sleep together for the first time.
Yeah.
And I just remember like totally forgetting that we were on a film set.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just like the only thing I could see was like the apex of the house. I couldn't see any crew. I could just see Jesse sprinting ahead of me. And we were like, and I didn't feel any kind of pressure of like, oh, they've called action, we need to get in front of the camera.
Yeah.
We were just running around for like a couple of minutes, and then we entered the scene, and there was no sense of like panic from the crew or Chloe. And I like want to carry that feeling of freedom and kind of in everything I do now. And it was just like, as you said, it's like, I don't think the film's grief or the kind of weight of the film would work unless we as me and Jesse and Chloe are collective of crew invested equally in the kind of moments of joy and levity. And I think I feel equally as proud of like the early moments in the film as I do the later parts.
I've been reading a lot of obviously interviews with Chloe and with all of you, and there's a lot of talk about just that openness and that sense of having to be open to this experience and let yourself feel the feelings and just bring it all in, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the, I was talking to your costume designer the other day who told me, and I don't know if this is right, that Jesse, you weren't told about the kids performing a play in advance, that was kind of sprung on you as a surprise.
No, and I love that moment so much. And they're all giddy. Like, I knew they were all planning something. And Paul,
I got to go off and rehearse with them.
He was the giddiest of them all. Yeah. He was like, couldn't sit in his seat. He was so giddy.
But trying to wrangle performances. Like, it was the best feeling because you could see the children's, like the characters of the children, like Hamnet really wanting to be in the play and Susanna not really wanting to be in the play and like trying to rehearse it with them and then just Jack their faces.
Absolutely
loved it.
Loved doing that. And his little cackle went,
I love your face when you see.
I mean, I adored that. I found it the funniest, most gorgeous thing in the world.
It was lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were extraordinary. Jacoby in particular obviously has some heavy lifting to do, but what an incredible actor.
Yeah, incredible. Brilliant.
What about the kind of the Tudorness, the Shakespeareanness of it all? Like, you know, it seems like it's, you know, you didn't get the roughs. I don't know if you missed them or not, but you know, it was very lived in kind of it was very lived in period drama, I guess. Was that more comfortable, more fun?
I think Chloe had no interest in it kind of feeling stuffy or like removed from a kind of.
I mean, there's a part aspect of that, like Justine's character that she plays.
Yes.
You know, it's actually on it's a precipice of kind of paganism being like not being the kind of religion in England anymore, and Puritanism starting to come in and capitalism kind of starting to creep in and what that does. I think for us and for Chloe, for these, they're almost like animals, you know. Yeah. They're so deeply connected to their elemental nature and to nature that the Tudor aspect is about, it's about life, you know, for them. What, you know, my costume was my red corset, the dress that I wear at the beginning is made out of the bark of a tree. Yeah. The cloth is a very like organic, like life, it's alive, this costume. And I think you had a similar, like we needed to be able to live in them. And
it just would have felt like not that it would have been, it just would have felt so wrong to me to feel like tied into this costume feeling. And that's a testament to Malgoja's work, is that it feels to me totally period correct, but it wasn't in an attempt to like capture the period entirely. It was about capturing a feeling. And I think the heads of department across everything were so wonderfully disobedient where they wanted to be, because like we can just read a book and like watch a documentary about Tudor times, and that's not what this group of creatives, that wasn't the task that we were set out to, or that we set out for ourselves to like accomplish. It was one of trying to capture these like planets colliding and like what happens as a result of it. And if, thank God we lost the roughs, to be honest.
Absolutely. So would you be working with Chloe again? Will she direct the Sander film, or will you get parts in Buffy? I mean, have you got any plans?
Both would be fantastic.
Yeah. I'd do anything
with her. I would do anything with her in a heartbeat.
Amazing. Well, listen, I have to let you go, but thank you so much for joining us, Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. See ya.
Okay, that was Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley talking to Helen about Hamnet, which is in cinemas right now, folks. And Helen has also spoken to Chloe Zhao about that movie, and we will be running that interview along with a Team Empire discussion in our spoiler special feed in a week or so, so keep them peeled for that. Up next is James Vanderbilt, writer and director of Nuremberg, a star-studded drama about the aftermath of World War II and the Nuremberg trials, in particular the trial of one of the highest-ranking Nazi officers, Hermann Göring, played here by Russell Crowe. But Chris, I hear you cry, didn't that come out in cinemas last November? Why, yes it did! But as a Sky original movie, it now lives on Sky Cinema, as of today, in fact, and I've been holding on to this fascinating chat with Vanderbilt for this occasion. Vanderbilt is a really interesting guy, and I wish we had more time to dig into his career, because Eclectic doesn't even begin to cover it. As a screenwriter, he made his name with Zodiac, but he's also written both murder mystery movies for Adam Sandler, points for that, a couple of amazing Spider-Mans, Screams 5 and 6, and much, much more. You just cannot pin this guy down. And this, his second movie as director a few years after his first, Truth, which starred Robert Redford and Cate Blanchett, has some really great standout sequences in which Michael Shannon and Russell Crowe go toe-to-toe in a courtroom. I asked him about those sequences, about showing real footage of the Holocaust during the courtroom scenes, about assembling an all-star cast, about holding on to this film and developing it for over a decade until he could get it made, and much, much more. Do please enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by the writer and director of Nuremberg, James Vanderbilt. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you, sir?
I'm not too bad. Not too bad at all. I mean, this movie is fascinating to me. So this is a film that you've been developing, if I'm right in thinking, for well over a decade now. Was there a possibility that this might have been, did you ever intend for this to be your directorial debut?
You know, it's interesting. I think there was, it was certainly in the running if it had come together. I think I was 13 years ago when I started working on it, I wanted to direct it. I was nervous about the level of the stakes to the story and for it being my first movie, but I also didn't necessarily want to let anyone else direct it. So it was a little bit of a, if some brilliant director came along who I loved, I would have probably given it to them because I didn't necessarily have as much confidence then. But luckily it took a long time and I was able to direct my first film, which was a smaller film, and, sort of get my sea legs a little bit and the confidence needed to tackle this one.
Most people's sea legs don't come with Robert Redford. So I love what you call Truth a smaller film.
He's helpful. It was a smaller film, but it was helpful for it to be Robert Redford. It was the deep end of the pool I was thrown into. Let me put it to you that way. But it was also, listen, with actors like it was him and Cate Blanchett, and I mean, such terrific actors, you know, you sort of can't help but, you know, go, okay, we're really doing this. You know, I can't be intimidated because I've got Bob and Cate on set.
It's the same with this as well. I mean, almost every scene in the first 20, 25 minutes of this movie, as you were setting up your characters and you're just introducing the audience to an amazing new character actor with pretty much every single scene. So it starts off, you go, oh, okay, Michael Shannon's in this, brilliant. Oh, now Rami Malek's in this. Oh, here's Russell Crowe. Oh, God, here's Leo Woodall. Oh, now John Slattery's in the film. Well, that's surely it. And then Richard E. Grant turns up, for God's sake. So yep. it's a hell of a cast. I mean, as a huge fan of ensemble World War II-centric movies, you know, things like Bridge Too Far and obviously, you know, Torah, things like that, The Longest Day, Judgment at Nuremberg. Did you feel a pressure in a way to deliver with a great ensemble cast?
I definitely did. And I really wanted to. And I love that experience when I go see a film of, you know, when you go, oh, it's that guy, you know, it's just sort of, there's something lovely about it. You know, the other thing with ensemble films is you only have so much time with each character. And so I find that having, you know, a familiar face who the audience has some experience with really helps you sort of identify that person, so that when Richard E. Grant walks in as Sir David Maxwell Fife, you're not sort of necessarily trying to figure out the character so much as you're going, oh, I know who this character is. It's Richard E. Grant. Okay. So I think that there's a pleasure in that in an ensemble film. But then also it's a murderer's row of actors. I mean, Russell described it as walking into a saloon and everyone's a gunfighter.
And he's bringing it. He's got his six shooters strapped to his side in this. There are phenomenal scenes between him and Rami. There's a great courtroom showdown between him and Michael Shannon as well. What was it like directing those scenes, those kind of one-on-one scenes between great actors?
I mean, it's just such a privilege as a director to do it. The courtroom was fascinating because it was a 22-page cross-examination scene. And so the first AD said, okay, obviously we're going to break this up over 3 or 4 days. And, you know, we'll start here and then we'll stop here at the end of the first day. And I said, Michael and Russell aren't going to want to do that. They're going to want to do the whole thing. And she was like, there's no way. And I said, no, I will. And I went to Russell and Michael. And they both said, oh, yeah, we're going to do the whole thing. Like, we don't want to stop mid emotional beat and then go back to the hotel and then 12 hours later trying to find that moment again. So I think I nearly gave her a heart attack when I told her that. But we set up four cameras, two on Michael, two on Russell, and they did all 22 pages in 25-minute takes. And it was incredible just to watch them. Word perfect, not missing a beat, and they're tearing each other apart. So it was just, as a director, you kind of want to pinch yourself, you know. It's sort of, at the end of the first take, I had to remember to call cut, because I was just like, I was just watching it, and I was like, I'm in charge. Cut. Okay, great. So it was amazing. And 300 extras, and they all applauded at the end of each take. I mean, it was truly one of the most amazing days I've ever had on a film set.
My God, how long did each take, roughly?
It was 20, each one was about 25 minutes.
Okay.
And that's, by the way, you know, digital film, you can do that now. You can run 25-minute takes, but it was, they were tireless, you know, and it just, I think we did seven takes, because you have to cover, obviously, and they have to cover all the other different people in the courtroom, but it was a masterclass in acting.
The majority of which take did you use?
I think we live in take one, and then a lot of take three, and then a little bit of take seven, because at that point we're very wide. And I started pretty medium to tight on them, because they both, and Rami's this way too, all three of them are take one actors. They all come off the blocks really quickly. You know, some actors have to warm into it, and three or four is their sweet spot. But Michael and Russell and Rami, from take one, you're off to the races. So I didn't want to waste that on a wide. I wanted to be right there. And so I saved the very big wides till the end, when we knew we had it.
Speaking of the courtroom sequence, leads me to another incredibly harrowing and moving sequence in the trials, where we see footage from various concentration camps, and it's actual footage that you use in the film. What did you show in the courtroom when you were filming? Because some of the reaction shots from the actors seem so real. Did you actually show footage in the room?
Yes, we showed the actual footage that you see in the film. You know, we brought in a projector. We didn't want to green screen or comp it in or fake it, you know. And in reality, the film they showed was almost an hour long, and we only show about 5 to 6 minutes of it. But it was all footage that was shown in court that day. And, you know, with our wonderful actors, as I sort of cast it, I said, look, I know you all love doing research, which is great. Do me a favor, don't watch the film as part of your research, because I want it to be fresh on the day for you. And they all agreed to it. And on the day, we brought everybody in. I had four cameras again that day. So I lined each camera up with one of our leads. And I went out 300 extras, and I, you know, sort of said, okay, this is, you know, for our background actors, this is what we're going to be doing today. And it's going to be a tough day, but I think it's very important. You know, we had a moment of silence. And then we showed the film, and, you know, we've great actors in our movie. So I don't want to say no acting was required, because they are playing characters, mm-hmm. but the images you see of them are them seeing that footage for the first time. And I think those images are as powerful today as they were 80 years ago. And I was always very important to me to show the real film, to not shoot anything for it, to not, you know, we don't have music under it pushing it. You know, it's just, it's, I think we do it as dryly as possible, because I want you, the viewer, to be in the same seats that they in the courtroom were 80 years ago.
In terms of that, so Rami and Richard and Michael, and, you know, they are all prepared for the footage that they're about to see. If you're an extra, if you're a supporting artist, or even a day player coming in for that, to prepare yourself for that psychologically must have been really interesting. How did you take care of extras and supporting artists who might have reacted adversely to that footage?
They were incredible. We let them know what was going to happen ahead of time. They knew before they walked in on the day too. It was on the call sheet that this is what we were going to be doing. You know, we told them if they needed to step out or needed to not participate, it was by their choice. Nobody left. Everybody stayed. You know, and it was also, we shot in Hungary. So it's a lot of people who their parents and their grandparents went through World War II. And then, you know, the communists came in. So they have dealt in that country with a lot of oppression. And, you know, all of the stuff we did in the courtroom, a lot of Michael's opening speech as well, sort of about tyranny and you know, the evil that men do, really resonated there with them, apart from our film. Just in terms of the history of the country, and they were amazing and incredible.
There's a moment in that sequence where Göring puts on sunglasses, which I believe he did in the actual trial as well. For you, because that could be interpreted in a number of ways. For you, what's going through his mind at that moment? Is he shutting out the guilt of what he's done, or is he being very blasé and glib about the whole thing, or is there something else going on there?
I think he's trying to, and Russell and I talked about this too, because that was definitely a choice. And just to tell it for your viewers and your listeners, there were sunglasses in the courtroom because the lights were so bright in order to be able for the film cameras to film the trial. So it was so hot under those lights that they gave everybody in the courtroom sunglasses if they wanted to wear them. So it looks a little silly initially because you sort of go, sunglasses in the courtroom then. But with that moment with Russell, we talked about that he's trying to shut it out. He's trying to not pay attention to it, possibly conceal any kind of emotional response he's having to the film that he doesn't want anyone else to see. But I think he's going into his hole a little bit as much as he can.
Was Göring, in a way, one of the reasons why he wanted to do this, to examine the mentality of a monster, essentially, a very charming and seductive and intelligent monster, but a monster nonetheless?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, in my, you know, somebody once described my IMDb page as somewhat schizophrenic. you know, so I've worked on a lot of different films and a lot of
I don't know what you mean.
No, but it is something I do seem to keep coming back to, not of my own volition, but is trying to dissect the nature of evil and the evil that men do. Zodiac was sort of about that. Truth is about that in certain ways. And this is about that. And, you know, the thing I found amazingly interesting about Göring as a character was that he was known to be so charming and funny. And, you know, someone once described him as the best dinner party guest you'll ever have over to your house, you know, and which are things we do not associate with Adolf Hitler or the Nazis. And so the idea of someone so charming who yet was able to do the things that he did, or at the very least turned a blind eye to the things that were going on, the duality of that. And then the idea of the story about a psychiatrist who has this man dropped in his lap, essentially, and goes, oh, I think I may have an opportunity to dissect the nature of evil. What sets this man apart from men like me? And the conclusions he comes to. I just sort of jumped at the chance to tell that story.
Going back to the idea, the wider idea of why you wanted to make this movie and why you spent 13 years developing this film, has there always been an inherent fascination with World War II for you? I believe, like myself, I lost one of my grandfathers in World War II, and I believe you also had grandparents who passed away in World War II, who died in World War II as well, certainly fought in World War II.
They fought in World War II. I was lucky enough that they came back.
Okay.
But I had both of them, and I sort of grew up with both of them telling me stories about that time period. And so for me, you know, and our generation, I feel like it's obviously we didn't live through it, but we have loved ones who did. I have friends who lost family members in the camps, and that time period just sort of feels tangible to me. It's something that kind of is in recent past, and I can reach out and touch. And I have kids now. I have, you know, my two oldest are teenagers. And when I talk to them about that time period, it's like talking to them about the American Revolution. It just feels so far in the past. And so I think one of the things that was exciting to me about telling this story is bringing that past back to life again. I think we forget the past at our peril.
Absolutely. So for you, was this a cautionary tale? The fact that it's really interesting that you're focusing on the aftermath of World War II and on the Nuremberg trials and on the attempts by good men to rein in evil, which is something that, without getting too preachy about things, doesn't seem to be happening an awful lot these days.
I mean, I think it's a cautionary tale, but I also think, if, you know, at least in my perspective, it's a hopeful tale because it is a moment in history where good men sort of made the harder choice. You know, the U.S. Army certainly, and many of the other armies, the British didn't want to put the Nazis on trial at all. Neither of our countries did. You know, there was a standing order from Churchill and Roosevelt that the Nazi high command was to be shot in the head 48 hours from capture. And Justice Jackson and Sir David Maxwell Fife, Richard E. Grant's character, sort of stood up and said, no, we can't do that. We have to put these men on trial for their lives. We have to take this risk. And it has to be international. It can't just be the U.S. doing it or Great Britain doing it. It has to be a coalition. We need the French. We need the Russians, who nobody was really getting along with at that point. It was sort of the beginning of the Cold War, to put together the first international tribunal. The case law didn't exist for it. They had to write the case law as they were doing it. It's sort of like, I describe it as sort of building the airplane while you fly it. but it's, I think it's an extraordinary thing. And Michael Shannon has a line in the movie where he says, I believe this to be a good act. And I think it was. So I think there's hope in that story, you know?
We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left, James. So it's a tough thing to compress 13 years of development into this time period. But how did the film... let's give it a go. How did the film develop over that time period? Was it markedly different when you started off to what we see now?
No, I think the most of the development happened in the early years, because truly the one of the biggest challenges was figuring out the structure and how to write it, because Jack's book, which is wonderful, is just sort of about Kelly and Goering. And so I felt like, oh, okay, this is going to be a smaller kind of two-hander, these men in a cell kind of probing each other. But then as I began to research it, I read about Justice Jackson and how hard the trials were to put on and his ultimate clash with Goering in the courtroom. And so I went, oh, I thought my movie was over here in this cell, but I think it's also here in this courtroom. And then I read about Leo Woodall's character, Howie Trias, the translator, and his story. And I went, oh my gosh, I think my movie's also over here. And it just grew, which as a writer is wonderful, but terrifying, because, you know, so much of, you know, adaptation is subtraction. You have a 350-page book. You have to fit it into 120 pages of screenplay. And this thing just kept growing and growing and growing. So the development of it for myself just took a long time to kind of wrestle this thing into what I thought was, you know, and I also wanted it to feel cinematic. I wanted it to feel like a thriller. So many movies I love and grew up with, like JFK or Apollo 13 or Glory, are about serious subjects, but they're not spinach movies. They're not, you know, take your medicine, do your homework. And we all know those movies. And you're like, yeah, I know. I guess I should see the serious movie. And I really wanted this not to feel like that. I wanted it to be a full cinematic emotional meal. So getting that right was important.
And cinematic is important in that as well, because it was always a movie from the off. Because the is such a sprawling subject matter, and you were developing these different characters along different lines, was part of you ever tempted at any point to pursue it as a TV series where you could focus on Jackson one episode and then switch to Kelly and another episode, Goering another episode, so on and so forth?
For me, no, never. I'm I love television, don't get me wrong, but I'm a movie guy. I love movies and I love the big screen. And I feel like, you know, precisely because of that, films like these don't always get made anymore. And I think it's important to make films like this and make them for the big screen. So I was always about wrestling it into the shape that felt cinematic and not the limited series. There are a lot of great limited series out there. This didn't need to be one of them.
Absolutely. This is the Empire Film Podcast. That is music to my ears. I have to say, I've got to let you go. But as you mentioned, you do have this wonderfully eclectic filmography. So were you working, were you dabbling with the screenplay for Nuremberg whilst also, oh, I don't know, writing murder mystery or something like that at the same time? And how did you keep those two lines separate?
Two separate. No, thank you so much. Well, it was easy not to put Adam Sandler gags into this movie. I do go back and forth, and I actually really enjoy going back and forth. You know, it's sort of, I feel like the you know, sometimes in Hollywood, if you do something and it works, they want you to just do that again and again and again. And it, you know, it can become your brand or whatever. And I always sort of go, the last thing I want to do after I finish something is something the same. So I remember after Zodiac, I got offered all these serial killer movies. And I was like, you out of your mind? I'm never, it's like, I'm not doing that again. So yeah, there is a lot of juggling. And it's also, you know, you go where the career takes you and what people are making and not making. But I would always return to this and always try and make it better, always trying to get actors attached, always trying to get financing for it. So I'm just very lucky that we got it made 13 short years later.
Absolutely. I love it. We can't pin you down. James, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Great to see you, sir.
Take care. Thanks a lot. Okay, that was James Vanderbilt, and Nuremberg is on Sky Cinema right now, as a matter of fact. And that is it for this special episode of the Empire Podcast. Episode 700, all 3 hours or so of it, will be in your feeds soon enough, and I hope you'll agree that it's worth the wait. If you're listening to this in the morning or the afternoon of Friday, January 9th, and you're in London, and you do fancy coming along to see the show live, there may be returns available either online at kingsplace.co.uk, or you could turn up at the box office and chance your arm there. There might be returns on the door. So turn up and you never know. It'll be absolutely worth it. We have amazing guests. We have us giggling idiots, of course. Loads of film-related fun. All the usual stuff. But until then, it's goodbye from me. I'm off to write that Santa Claus movie for Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley. Who's Afraid of Virginia Elf? Anyone? Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.